brace for impact today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A blizzard shuts down Washington, and this Moscow resident is there.
I think most Russians would scratch their head at the idea of, you know, the capital city, no less, shutting down for 3, 4, or 5 days just because of a little snow.
Also, eating mutton flaps, unhealthy but delicious.
They look like bacon. There's more fat than meat, if you like. So when it's roasting on a spit, it, you know, falls down and makes a pretty good smell.
Plus, how an oil company promising to go green can be like a person vowing to lose weight.
And so they declare they're going to lose 100 pounds. But you don't change your diet and you don't exercise more. So the goal without action doesn't mean much.
It's all today on The World. We start our show today with the price of oil and cauliflower, as in how oil prices are affecting the cost of that vegetable. And if you're a parent and trying to get your kids to eat more vegetables, this is not a good news story. One head of cauliflower now costs more than $8 in Canada. That's $8 Canadian, or about $5.60 U.S. Ian Austin covers Canada for the New York Times. I asked him to explain what cauliflower economics are all about north of the border, and he told me it has a lot to do with Canada's number one export, oil, and how oil prices affect the value of a nation's currency.
As oil prices go, so does the Canadian dollar, and that's been a really dramatic decline since October. 2 years ago today, the Canadian and American dollars were, you know, roughly the same, roughly at parity. Right now, you're taking a 30% hit on the Canadian dollar. So the net effect of all that is, when you combine it with the drought and now flooding problems in California, there's a shortage of cauliflowers, so they're expensive to begin with. You add 30% currency differential on them, and all of a sudden you have the $8 Canadian cauliflower.
Wow. I mean, it's kind of a weird metric to use cauliflower. How important is it to the Canadian diet?
Well, I don't think the cauliflower crisis is so much reflects the importance of cauliflower. It's just that when people were going into stores and seeing them at $8, I mean, you know, Canadian incomes, if you exclude the exchange, are about the same. Prices were about the same as in the United States. It's pretty shocking. I'm not talking about grocery stores in, you know, high-end neighborhoods in Montreal or Toronto, just like every grocery store, small suburban ones, downtown ones, any of them. And not just cauliflower. It's the most extreme, but all vegetables, broccoli, all fresh vegetables that have to be imported in the winter, Canadian winter from the States, have gone up dramatically.
Right. So oil price drops, value of the Canadian dollar goes down, and the cost of vegetables goes up. I guess cauliflower, other vegetables, are now a splurge for Canadians. Is it indeed the same thing for other vegetables?
Well, I mean, of course, it isn't for things like root vegetables. So I think there is a renewed interest in turnips, rutabagas, and carrots in Canada that perhaps there wasn't before. But and of course, you know, there's always the option of frozen vegetables, which people are reluctantly or otherwise going towards. And increasingly, Canadian grocers are scrambling around to try and, you know, bring in stuff from places we don't normally see produce. There's, you know, my local grocery store now has a lot of things from North Africa, Spain, and South Africa.
So these are all little bits that we can see more of potentially because of the drop in the price of oil?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's quite a dramatic shock to the country's currency. Now, so far, the Bank of Canada said yesterday that the overall inflationary effect of the increased food prices has been offset by the drop in oil prices. I mean, people pay less for gas, people pay less to heat their homes, which is a critical thing in the winter. But there is a point where it's going to cross, and you know, it's going to start creeping into other products. I've seen a $10 box of Cheerios. As spring merchandise comes into stores, well, a lot of that's imported, and regardless of where it comes from, Canadian merchants pay in U.S. dollars for them. So, you know, we've already seen in the Apple store a year and a half ago, an iPad mini cost kind of the same. Now it costs $90 Canadian more if you just compare the two prices. And Apple's actually absorbing some of the exchange rate difference of that.
Ian Austin there. He covers Canada for the New York Times. Cauliflower is a serviceable gauge of oil prices in the near term, but thinking further off about the future of oil is quite another proposition. Leonardo Maugeri is an oil and gas expert, former head of the Italian oil and gas company Eni. And in a 2012 report for Harvard, he predicted a collapse in oil prices like the one we're seeing now. So, Leonardo, what did you see in 2012 that the rest of the world did not?
I saw a huge growth of production capacity in the world, which was taking place because of a super cycle of investments. And so I say, look, if you look at what's happening now, these investments that have been made in the last few years will produce no production in the next years. I mean, from 2015 on. And so we will have a great and immense growth of production that for sure will determine a collapse of oil prices.
The investments were basically about looking for new sources of oil, was that it?
On the one hand, on new sources of oil, and on the other hand, on the redeveloping mature oil fields in many parts of the world, because there is something that people who are not familiar with the oil industry don't know, that usually, on average, in the world, we can extract around 35% on average of oil from the existing fields. But if you use more advanced technologies, you may extract also more than 50%. Look, for example, in the case of Iraq. All the new production from Iraq comes from old, mature oil fields redeveloped with new technologies. So they are not new oil fields. And this is happening in Russia, for example, and in many other parts of the world.
If the price of oil stays low, are there any oil companies that are at risk of collapsing?
No, maybe just small and medium-sized oil companies operating in the United States, in the North Sea. Periods like this, the bigger companies eat up the smaller companies. So I think there will be a reshaping of the oil industry.
Now, Saudi Arabia is not willing to cut production to bring the price of oil back up. Why is that?
There is a simple reasoning by the Saudis. They say, now everyone looks at Saudi Arabia to cut production, but Saudi Arabia say, why I should be the only one to cut production while all the other countries in the world are producing at full throttle, the United States, Russia, Iraq, Iran, and whatever. Look, do you think the United States are eager to cut their production in order to sustain the price? No, because, for example, the U.S. government cannot decide something like this, or the Russian government cannot decide something like this. It's really difficult to have a voluntary cut of production by other countries in the world other than Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is simply not ready to make such a cut as a gift to all the other countries in the world.
You know, it seems like low oil prices would be a benefit to the economy because consumers have more money to spend, transport and freight costs go down as oil goes down. But as we heard a few minutes ago, with the price of cauliflower in Canada, that's not always the case. Why is that?
You know, the United States are an exception to the world because there is a direct correlation between the price of crude oil and the price of gasoline. While, for example, in Europe or in other countries in the world, including Canada, taxes on oil products are very high. So the consumers doesn't benefit fully of the plunge of oil prices.
So, Leonardo, you predicted this current glut and a trough of prices in 2012. Are you able to predict now how long it's going to last?
I have no crystal ball, of course, but my view is that unless the price of oil dips below $25 per barrel, and not just for one day, but for at least 1 or 2 months, I think that at that point there could be a reaction, a concerted reaction by producers. But otherwise, 2016 will still be a year of very low prices. Maybe an inflection point for the prices may arrive in 2017.
Leonardo Maugeri, a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. He's also a former oil executive and predicted the current oil price slump in 2012. Leonardo, thank you.
Thank you.
Oil and gas companies would love prices to go back up, but that doesn't mean they can afford to just wait for that to happen. Last month, nearly 200 countries committed in Paris to cutting their greenhouse gas emissions. So the pressure is on all of us to figure out how to do that and for oil companies to adapt to a new reality, as the world's Jason Margolis reports.
If you're in the oil business, you might think your best days are behind you. Oil is selling for rock-bottom prices. Your product is blamed for destroying the planet. And here's what the leader of the free world thinks of it.
Now we've got to accelerate the transition away from old, dirtier energy sources. Rather than subsidize the past, we should invest in the future.
To state the obvious, though, if you're an oil company, you produce oil. Energy economist John Riley at the MIT Sloan School of Management says companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron are facing a classic business challenge.
Could the horse and buggy manufacturers become automobile producers, or is some other company going to, because they're more innovative or not bound by what they're already doing, able to be more fleet of foot and move in the other direction?
The other direction being tomorrow's fuel source. But before we pity the poor oil companies, remember, these are the richest companies in the world.
Most of them have lots of cash. And so if there's a successful alternative, if they don't develop it, they probably can acquire those companies and transition that way.
I reached out to several oil companies to ask about their long-term strategies, Shell, BP, Hess, Chevron, and ExxonMobil. None agreed to an interview. But Statoil in Norway did. Bjorn Sverdrup says they welcome the interview.
We're in the energy business, and the climate issue is a very integrated part of the energy business.
He says Statoil is looking beyond oil by investing in renewable energies like offshore wind.
We're already involved in wind farms producing energy for more than 600,000 households. Going forward, we will continue to deepen that position.
Now, it's interesting. When I hear the name Statoil, I think oil. I don't think wind. Do you see a time when Statoil could have no oil in its portfolio, or is that not realistic?
So the energy transition will take a long period of time. We need to change the infrastructure of societies. You know, only last year there were sold 70 million vehicles.
It's actually closer to 90 million sold worldwide. Vehicles fueled by oil. Translation, oil isn't going away anytime soon. Still, many oil and gas companies are investing in other fuel sources like cleaner-burning biofuels. Paul Simpson says oil companies are making progress toward a lower carbon future, but they need to do a lot more. Simpson is head of CDP, a nonprofit that helps companies measure their environmental impacts. He's at the World Economic Forum in Davos this week and ducked out to speak with me on his cell phone. He says they grade companies on how they're confronting climate change.
The oil and gas companies are really large to getting a C or a D.
Yeah, nobody above a C. That's not very good. That's failing.
C is kind of doing some of the right things, but not good enough yet.
10 oil and gas companies have formed an organization pledging to battle climate change, but their platform is thin on specifics. John Sturman, another professor at MIT's Sloan School of Business, says declaring a goal is great, but it needs to be backed up with action. He says oil companies are acting like a grossly overweight person whose doctor has just told them they're risking their life.
And so they declare they're going to lose 100 pounds. But you don't change your diet and you don't exercise more. So the goal without action doesn't mean much.
Oil companies face a tough reality, though. They hold valuable assets, oil underground, but simply can't keep drilling.
In order to limit warming, those assets cannot be utilized. That carbon cannot be burned. If they do burn it, it destroys our economy and it destroys human welfare, so it will have no value because, as the CEO of Unilever, Paul Polman, says, you can't make any money on a dead planet.
Now, those are the words of a professor of management. Sturman says he's not merely presenting an ethical argument here. He's making a business case, too. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boston.
Marco Werman here with The World. Think back to elementary school. Now imagine trying to master some of those big new concepts you're being taught, while at the same time you're trying to learn the language the teacher is speaking in. That's what many immigrant kids all over the country are dealing with. Our next story takes us to a school in Southern California where kids are succeeding at both, mastering their subjects and learning English. Jean Guerrero of station KPBS visited the school to find out what's going on there.
Why in the studio?
Fourth graders are bustling around, producing a live televised newscast at this Magnet Elementary School in Vista in San Diego County.
And our news starts right now.
Their program includes news, interviews with other students, and even weather reports.
I'm the meteorologist.
The meteorologist, Elena Gomez. She's 9 years old, and English is her second language, like many of her classmates. Her parents are from Mexico, so Spanish came first. But as part of the news crew, she's had to improve her English.
I learned that I had to speak up, because otherwise people who are watching the video would not hear me at all. Everything that we learned was they taught us in a fun way.
Learning English in a fun, hands-on way is what this school is doing. It's called the Casita Center for Technology, Science, and Math, and it's beating all others in the district on tests that evaluate English literacy and math. Casita's scores are also above state and county averages. Principal Laura Smith says Casita works well with children from foreign backgrounds because of its interactive approach.
A lot of times, students, while they're experiencing their learning, while they're in an innovative environment, it really helps build their language skills.
Smith explains that Casita's program is neither an immersion nor a bilingual program, but offers a fast track to fluency for English language learners, the fastest growing student population in the U.S.
And it's all inquiry based. So the cognitive load is on the students, where the students are doing a lot of the thinking and the inquiring, and the teachers are facilitating that learning.
Students are compelled to express themselves to get projects done, like producing the TV news show. And that means getting into discussions, asking questions, rather than relying on rote memorization and worksheets. Experts are finding this approach is the best way to teach English language learners, and any students for that matter. It puts them at the center of the learning process, keeps their attention, and gets new words and concepts to stick. At Casita, some classes take place outside.
So our motto has been No Child Left Inside.
And outside the classroom, it's pretty beautiful. The area is overflowing with California coastal sage scrub, native plants, and animals. A recent science class, in English, had students searching for evidence of mammals. Mostly, they found piles of feathers and scat.
Ew, it smells now.
They also took water samples.
What is it? I don't know, but it's cool.
That's Adrian Contreras. He was searching for evidence of invertebrates in the wild.
It's fun. We find a lot of animals down here.
His parents are from Mexico, and he grew up speaking Spanish. At Casita, his English has improved quite a bit.
I'm starting to use it more than Spanish.
He says the immersive approach helps him learn every subject. Science and reading, in English, are his favorites. His teacher, Gail Sorelli, also notices more enthusiasm among students learning in a more hands-on way.
The kids love to be down there. You know, certainly I've seen kids who might be really quiet in a big classroom setting, might not want to raise their hand or ask a question, and I've seen them down there get really excited about something.
Later in the day, Sorelli holds up a metal cube filled with mud that she calls an invertebrate trap. The students crowd around. They'd place the cube in a pond to capture mosquito eggs and other creatures.
So what we can do is take it back to class. Whoa. And scrape off some of the gook, put it under a microscope, and see what we have. Okay?
Okay.
So we'll leave it.
Then it's back to the classroom to examine their findings. Right. With the students so immersed in that, they seem not to notice that they're learning in a new language. For The World, Jean Guerrero, San Diego.
Okay, if you're not driving, take your hand and place it just below your ribs on the side of your belly, that soft, paunchy part. On a lamb, that would be known as the mutton flap. It's loaded with fat, and that's part of the reason those shawarmas you eat are so juicy. The giant log of lamb on the spit is made with mutton flaps. In the Pacific Island nation of Tonga, mutton flaps are really popular because they're tasty, but also because they're really cheap. The meat is imported in bulk from countries like New Zealand, and it's available in the frozen section of every Tongan supermarket. But the fact that mutton flaps are so widely consumed has become a problem for a nation with a serious obesity problem. My partner at the BBC, Katie Watson, went to Tonga to report on this.
Well, when I was there, one of the Tongans I was meeting said that there was a generation that grew up on mutton flaps. It's worth pointing out that, you know, mutton flaps also went to places like Samoa, Fiji, and Pacific Islanders have acquired a taste for them. Speaking to most people there, you know, they talked about how delicious they were. They realized how unhealthy they are. But nevertheless, they've become very much a part of the diet in the Pacific Islands. And Tonga, where I visited, 90% of people are obese or overweight. So fatty meats obviously contributes to that.
And that obesity is also bringing down the life expectancy in Tonga, right?
That's right. The government is trying to tackle this, but at the same time, it's a very hard sell in Tonga where feasting is such a central part of people's lives.
Given what kebab smells like when it's grilling, what do straight-up mutton flaps smell like when they're cooking?
They smell pretty delicious, actually. I mean, they look like bacon. There's about more fat than meat, if you like. It's about 40% fat, but it looks pretty white. So when it's roasting on a spit, it, you know, falls down and makes a pretty good smell. But it's also the quantity, I think, that's most important. It's just the volume, really, of food that's eaten. And that's an issue that's around the world, but you see it very much in Tonga.
Are there any food activists? Like, who's the Jamie Oliver of Tonga?
No, there aren't. And I think going down to the diabetes clinic in the main hospital, speaking to the doctor, she said that she always feels like she's drowning. You know, she still has to deal with the people who have now got type 2 diabetes and, you know, have complications. I met a girl who lost her leg as a teenager because she had acquired type 2 diabetes. You know, these are the issues. They have to look after these people for a long time. And, you know, this is generations to change.
You talked about this culture of feasting in Tonga and the kind of luaus or barbecues. Have mutton flaps actually kind of changed the whole vibe of these feasts? I mean, I can imagine that if it's fish, people kind of eat, and fish doesn't really slow you down.
Well, I mean, going to the feast that I went to, it was suckling pig and those kind of heavy meats that were really kind of predominant. So, I mean, there was fish, but there was less of it. And that's what I find quite surprising. You're on an island and, you know, you'd kind of expect it just be fruit, vegetables and fish. But no, I mean, we're talking lamb and pig. I mean, in terms of slowing people down, the other thing that was quite interesting is, I mean, it's such a small place. Everybody is traveling by car. I mean, I was walking along the harbour one evening, probably about 25 minutes to get back to where I was staying, and people winding down the windows saying, do you need a lift? Where you are heading is really far away. You just think, it's really not.
My partner at the BBC, Katie Watson, telling us about Tonga and their consumption of mutton flaps. Thanks very much, Katie.
Thanks.
They were stuck in a Lebanese refugee camp, but some Syrian kids are now sledding for the first time in their lives in Ontario. Later, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. ISIS destroys a centuries-old Christian church in Iraq, and an American archaeologist reacts.
Numb, I would say. Despair, sadness.
But no sadness in Canada, where Syrian refugee children are discovering the joys of snow.
They love sledding. They're going to make great Canadians.
Both stories coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Elijah the prophet must be weeping. Those words came from a Roman Catholic chaplain in the U.S. Army after he learned about the destruction of St. Elijah's Monastery in Iraq. The monastery had stood as a place of worship for 1,400 years, but satellite photos published by the Associated Press this week show that the stone buildings have been leveled completely. ISIS now controls much of Iraq and Syria, and it has carried out a campaign to erase anything from the region's history that doesn't jibe with their extremist interpretation of Islam. St. Elijah's is only one part of the story. ISIS has also killed thousands of civilians. But we want to talk about what's happening to the region's cultural heritage for the next few minutes. Michael Peppard is with the Department of Theology at Fordham University. To start off, Michael, what went through your mind when you read about what happened to St. Elijah's?
Numb, I would say. Despair, sadness, the tragedy that has been taking place among civilians in Syria and Iraq is paralleled now by what we're seeing with destruction of cultural heritage. And when we see a building like that, in which Christians had worshipped so many years ago, completely razed to the ground, completely flattened, the feeling is just loss of an ancient Christian heritage.
We've seen videos of ISIS fighters destroying historical sites like the one at Palmyra, but apparently they're also trying to profit from the antiquities of the Middle East. What are they doing exactly?
What we've been seeing over the last few years, two different ways of treating Christian antiquities or other antiquities that don't fit within a very constricted notion of culture that ISIS is promulgating. On the one hand, they're destroying monumental items, things like St. Elijah's Monastery, things like in Mosul and Syria, destroying buildings and statues. On the other hand, anything that is portable that has been discovered, for example, through a systematized looting operation is being monetized and used as a currency and sold abroad. And the State Department is reporting that this is probably the second largest source of income, and with the drop in oil prices, is perhaps even becoming one of the major sources of income for ISIS.
If they're actually selling off artifacts in terms of artistic preservation, could that be kind of good news anyway?
Well, it's a good question. There is a sense that if you have an object-oriented understanding about artifacts, that is, preserving the object is the most important thing, then I guess having it out of the ground and in someone's hands is a good thing. That being said, there's also a sense in which this feeds a continued black market and feeds a continued cycle of corruption. And so most people who study antiquities and do archaeology would say absolutely not. We don't want these things happening. The one final point I would also make is that these artifacts are important to Syrian national identity and Iraqi national identity. And when they get sent out of the country, most of them are never coming back. Most of them are going to go to private collectors, and they will not see the light of day, either by scholars or by folks in Syria and Iraq.
Now, during his State of the Union address, President Obama mentioned conflicts that date back millennia, referring to the Mideast. And some have pointed out that the conflicts are actually much more recent. Your research, though, suggests that hundreds of years ago, religious life in the Mideast didn't have much conflict at all. Tell us more about that.
What we find, for example, in a town like Dura Europos in eastern Syria on the Euphrates, which is a city that I wrote about in my book, we find there a really shocking amount of cultural pluralism, and in language, in ethnicity, in religion, where you have the earliest Christian building that we have near one of the oldest synagogues that we have, near temples devoted to gods from Persia and gods from Greece and gods from Rome, and yes, the god of Judea. So we have an awful lot of religious diversity in a walled city that's roughly the size, I don't know, of New Haven, Connecticut, a very kind of compact downtown. And there are many other cities like that around Syria, Apamea, closer to the coast, that were quite cosmopolitan. Later in Christian history, even when Christianity engaged with Islam in the 8th and 9th centuries, there was still a very robust religious pluralism in Syria and in Iraq, where you have Arabic-speaking Christians, Syriac-speaking Christians engaging with the Muslim counterparts of their day.
So back in the present day, Michael, obviously the loss of human life at the hands of ISIS is the most appalling thing that's going on with that group. But the big picture from someone who studies history, what do we lose when so many historic sites and artifacts are being erased by civil war and extremism?
Well, as you say, the loss to human life is, of course, the most important, and Westerners and Western Christians should never lose sight of that. That being said, the loss of specific artifacts, specific buildings, and specific ritual practices from the people of Syria and the people of Iraq is very difficult to replace. It's hard enough to continue a longstanding tradition when you're in the place where it lives. And it becomes even more difficult through a diaspora, through a process of travel with refugees, when they can't necessarily return back and draw the spirit of the land and of the place.
Michael Peppard of Fordham University. He's the author of The World's Oldest Church, Bible, Art, and Ritual at Dura Europos, Syria. Michael, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
An obscure legal case in the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan is leaping into the headlines, and it's mainly because Amal Clooney, the wife of actor George Clooney, has gotten involved. In fact, she's become the target of attacks by Azerbaijan's government-controlled media. Amal Clooney is a very successful British attorney, as you may know, known for taking on difficult human rights cases. Reporter Natalia Antalava is just back from Azerbaijan. So, first of all, who is in jail, and what are the charges against them?
The person who is in jail, Mrs. Clooney is defending, is an investigative journalist and an extraordinary person, actually, whom I know personally, Khadija Ismailova. She's 39 years old. She is an incredibly courageous woman who has for years been digging up dirt on the Azeri government and exposing them, and has infuriated the government of Azerbaijan.
Does Khadija Ismailova seem to have solid evidence in her charges against the leaders of Azerbaijan?
Her evidence is extremely solid. She won numerous awards for the journalism that she has done, and she's probably I would say she's definitely the only true investigative journalism in the Caucasus, in this region. And yeah, she has done some very, very impressive reporting. On the other hand, the evidence against her in court so far has been very flaky, because the initial charge against her was that she was charged with, and this is quite bizarre, inciting suicide in one of her colleagues. And even though the colleague came to court and said, no, she had nothing to do with my attempted suicide, it was all about my ex-girlfriend, the judge refused to stop calling him the victim. She was then held in pretrial detention for several months, and subsequently she was charged with economic crimes. So this is the case that Amal Clooney is taking on and taking to the European Court of Human Rights.
So what about this other case related to a sex tape for blackmail against Khadija Ismailova? What's that about?
This is really how Khadija's troubles started back in 2014, at the time when Azerbaijan was preparing to host the Eurovision Song Contest. She was investigating the involvement of officials in some of the construction and the money laundering that was going on around some of the construction sites that were going up for the Eurovision Song Contest. She was warned to stop, and she didn't. And the next thing that happened is that media released, there was a public release of very intimate tapes of Khadija with a male. And it turned out that a camera had been installed in her bedroom. The government promised that they would investigate who released those tapes, but the investigation never actually happened. And it was soon after that she was imprisoned.
So Ismailova's defense team seems to think the charges against her are politically motivated. How did Amal Clooney get involved, and what is she trying to do?
Well, the announcement of the that she's taking on the case came on NBC's Meet the Press a few days ago, and it caused an absolute outrage in Azerbaijan, Azerbaijan's state-controlled media. There's no other media inside Azerbaijan, went on a full-blown attack against Clooney, saying that, among other things, that she's Armenian, and that explains why she would take on the case of Khadija Ismailova. And of course, Azerbaijan is at war with Armenia, at loggerheads with Armenia over the province of Nagorno-Karabakh. So that's it's very common to say that anyone who is the enemy of Azerbaijan is an Armenian.
Right. So it's almost like a negative thing.
That's right.
Amal Clooney, though, is not Armenian. Her parents are from Lebanon's Druze and Sunni Muslim community. How does Azerbaijan think they can get away with just a blatant lie?
Well, considering the stuff that they have been getting away with, it's not that surprising. And I think for the domestic consumption, that sort of thing works. You know, here is some Armenian, some famous Armenian that you vaguely heard about. And the reason she's doing that is not because she is a lawyer trying to help someone who is in need of her help, but because she's an Armenian. And I'm sure for the people who are watching nothing but the Azeri media, that will actually work.
Journalist Natalia Antalava speaking with me from Tbilisi in Georgia, just back from Azerbaijan. Thank you very much, Natalia.
Thank you.
If you look at any list of the safest places for women to visit, India will not be on it. In fact, in recent years, India has been considered by many as one of the worst places for female travelers. That has a lot to do with the high rate of violence against women in the country, but it may also have to do with all the unwritten rules that govern how Indian women are supposed to appear in public. One artist in Mumbai came up with a way to turn those rules on their head. Chavi Sachdev has a story.
For women who live and work and travel in India, getting around is an experience in segregation. Not only do we have women's seats, but also entire compartments. And in Mumbai, twice a day, a ladies' special, an entire train only for women. It's both amazingly convenient and ridiculously condescending. One minute, we might be groped, catcalled and objectified, and the next, we're told we're so vulnerable we need special privileges.
When a woman travels through a public space in India and a man travels through a public space in India, the experience is completely different.
That's multimedia artist Roshni Desai in Mumbai. She wanted to do something about this gilded cage feeling of public life, so she struck on the idea of taxis. Of course, there are women's only taxis, for women, driven by women, but this is not about that.
In Marathi, the word for only for women is Triyansathi. And so I decided, why not invert it and gift the men their own taxi and call it Purushan Sati. Purushan Sati means only for men.
Mumbai's taxis are known for their upholstery, cloths that cover the whole interior of the cab, which is usually a Fiat. Drivers pick out their own designs, and sometimes the results are quite eye-catching. Roshni is one of 20 artists who have designed one-off upholstery for a moving art installation collective called Taxi Fabric. They print it and outfit the cab for free. Roshni's design theme? Rules for men. I met with Ramji Pal, the driver of Roshni's men-only taxi. He seems quite proud of his unique interiors. On the seats and the roof, there's a cartoon of a mustachioed man with these rules written in Hindi. On the door panels are leering tongues and ogling eyes.
I like having this taxi fabric. When people sit in the taxi, it always gets a conversation going. They ask me about it. It's not a joke. They realize it's a serious thing.
Ramji drives his cab from 8:30 in the morning to about 8 at night. Every day he sees anywhere between 30 and 100 passengers. I chat with him in his taxi with my headphones on and my mic pointed at him, and we attract a small crowd. As we talk, it becomes clear that he, along with the men who've joined us, take these rules quite literally.
Sochenge man mein?
Front seat mein na baithe. Aisa kyun?
This is me. I ask them, these are rules. What about sitting in front? It says here that men shouldn't sit in the front seat. The first man says, ah, because they put their feet on the dashboard, or they sit with their feet on the seat. But all these rules, I asked, think about women. Do they ever sit in the front seat with the driver? Ramji, the taxi driver, says, no. If she's with the driver, she sits in the back. Women should only sit in the front if they are with their husband. This is the rule. What about this rule that says boys should be home by 7 p.m.? Is that how it is? This makes them laugh. Who gets told this? They don't answer. The unspoken answer, of course, is women. There's an informal curfew if you're a girl. So I push. Asking men to be home by 7 is silly, but women have to be home by 7? They ponder it for a while, and the whole time I have this feeling that they're on the verge of understanding the dichotomy, the double standard. Then, at the last minute, they drop the ball. Ramji, the taxi driver, says,
both men and women have rights, but they have to exercise them within limits.
Still, the fabric artist Roshni says the response has been fantastic. People find her online to tell her it made them stop and think.
Even to a woman, it looks really ridiculous and funny, and you know, it'll make you chuckle. You know, they say humor is the best form, you know, to convey a message.
One can hope. And now, excuse me, I have a seat waiting for me on the ladies' special train. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Big snowstorm, in case you didn't hear. Not the whole country, but some parts of the East Coast are getting totally slammed. Blizzard warnings, as much as 2 feet of snow could fall in Washington, and that's making headlines.
The Mid-Atlantic and Northeast brace today for a blizzard that could affect 50
The snow will just keep on coming. Washington right in the heart of the action.
The snow continues into Saturday, making travel near impossible.
Are you serious? This is a serious storm.
Washingtonians are phased, but not Charles Maines, who happens to be in Washington, away from his usual base of Moscow. You're used to weather like this, Charles. Is this a sociological experiment for you, a Muscovite taking notes on Americans dealing with a snowstorm?
Well, that's right. I mean, it seems as though, you know, I don't know what you would call it, sort of code orange or just complete full-on panic. But just sitting here and listening to the radio and, you know, watching a little television, you kind of hear about the power outages, downed wires, stay inside. You know, by all means, if you leave your home, you will die. And that seems to be kind of the message here. So
are people taking it seriously? What is the mood right now?
Well, you know, I think people have been sort of buying up goods at the shops. And, you know, I think that the key message here is that everyone seems to be kind of err on the side of caution. I mean, obviously, we've been through this before on the East Coast several times, in New York a few years ago. You guys got hammered, I think, last year, as I recall.
Yep.
And people just stock up just in case.
What is the one thing you've seen Washingtonians doing to prepare for the storm that, like, if a Russian were to see it, they'd either scratch their head or laugh?
Well, you know, I think the big thing is that Russians kind of handle the weather and they just take it in stride. You know, Moscow, after a big snowstorm, people still go to work. You know, it's not an excuse to show up late to work. The kids still go to school. I mean, it takes some really extraordinary weather to keep people in their homes. So Russians would come here and they'd kind of scratch their head at the idea of, you know, the capital city, no less, shutting down for 3, 4, or 5 days just because of a little snow.
Do they salt sidewalks in Moscow?
They do. They do salt sidewalks, but they also have this very kind of high-tech army of snowplows that come out in Moscow. They'll line up sort of 15 rows deep and clear the entire Moscow Ring Road in one pass. You also have some really high-tech gear. Like there's a snow plow with pincers, they call the golden hands, that kind of gobbles up snow and sort of sends it up a conveyor belt and gets it off the street. You also have mini snow, you know, kind of bobcat size things that clean the sidewalks. You know, and I think it's probably important to point out that Russians aren't doing a lot of their own snow clearing these days. It's a lot of migrants from Central Asia. Tajiks in particular have been keeping Moscow pretty clean these days.
What about some tricks that maybe Russians have for dealing with snow that we don't know about yet?
I mean, you know, there's sort of like the insane stuff on social media. There's some kind of fun stuff. It's like Russian over the top stuff, you know, how to clean your car, snow off your car. You just kind of crank the volume on your stereo till it just blows all the snow off.
Oh, that's good.
And then you also have sort of these kind of DIY elements that are used in the villages where, of course, they don't have snow plows. So you have people kind of creating their own homemade wooden snow plows, hooking them up to their cars and just kind of driving through the village roads, clearing off snow.
Do you think Muscovites are really more resilient when it comes to big snow, or is that just a stereotype?
You know, with a lot of stereotypes, there's just a little bit of truth in them, and I think this one may be accurate.
Okay. What is the word for snow in Russian?
Well, sneg is the word for snow, but when you go into some, talk about a blizzard or something like that, it's metel.
Yeah, here it's called Snowmageddon, and Moscow it's just called Tuesday, I guess.
Exactly.
Reporter Charles Maines in Washington, thank you.
Hey, thanks, Marco.
I get the snow panic south of us. Hey, remember the show comes out of Boston. But spare a thought for some people who've never seen snow and, after what they've been through, are loving it. That is a sound of pure joy. Kids from Syria sledding for the first time in their lives in Ontario, Canada. We'll have the video at PRI.org so you can actually see the huge smiles on their faces. 3 weeks ago, these kids and their mother, Amal Akhalaf, were in a refugee camp in Lebanon. But then a group of Canadians sponsored them to come to Canada. And today they're in Ontario, adjusting to their new lives and those snow-covered hills. David McNabb is one of the sponsors. And David, you're also the one who put out this video. Tell us about that day. When was this?
This was Saturday, January 16th at Armour Hill. It's a famous hill in Peterborough. Almost every kid has tobogganed there at some point or another.
Looks like a great hill for sledding.
Yeah, there's always a lot of kids. It's the place to go if you want to have some fun.
So the kids in the Akhalaf family had not seen snow before, right? How did they take to sledding?
I asked their mother if they had seen snow, and she said no. They had seen cold, but not snow. But as you can hear and see, they love sledding. They're going to make great Canadians.
That's all it takes, a love of snow?
Snow, Tim Hortons, maybe hockey and maple syrup, but I think they're well on the way.
All right, yeah, one down, what, 3 or 4 to go. So tell me about the Akhalafs and how you found out about them.
They actually they made their way to Lebanon, where they were basically hiding out, and they had applied to become refugees coming to Canada. Our group had all wanted to do something, so we reached out to the government and we were provided a list. We selected their profile off the list, and then we were connected with them, and our goal was to get them here. It was actually Maclean's magazine, Michael Friscalanti, that was able to put us in direct contact with her. He traveled to Lebanon and miraculously was able to find her.
Yeah, and for you, I mean, you're a police officer. Personally, what was going through your mind when you made the decision to work with this group and sponsor the Akhalafs?
I have to admit, at first, it seemed like a big task. It was overwhelming, and I was asking my wife, are you sure it's something we can do? And she's very good at doing her research and things like that. She had all the answers, and it was surprisingly clear how easy. So right away, it became something exciting. And it felt so good to be doing something useful to stop the suffering that we're seeing.
What of their dad, Amal's husband?
Amal is very optimistic that somehow she may hear from him. She's had no contact with him. He didn't come home, and it's been several years. So right now she does not know where he is or what his situation is.
What are the kids and their mother up to these days besides sledding?
About 2 or 3 days after arriving, they were enrolled in school. The kids are loving school, and I have to say Peterborough is a very welcoming place. The children here are so friendly. These kids love school like you wouldn't believe, and they're excited to go to school. Amal is also in school. She's enrolled in the local college and is taking an English course. She's excited. She gets on the bus and goes to school, and she has friends there too. They're adapting very well. And then in the time off, they're doing things. We're trying to organize some skating. They go shopping for clothes and some food, just trying to learn all the ins and outs of being real Canadians.
I don't know whether Ontario is going to be affected by this dumping of snow here in the U.S., but when are you going sledding next?
They're already crying to go sledding on Saturday. So you send us all the snow you like. We'll take it.
David McNabb in Ontario, Canada, thank you very much for speaking with us today. And thank you for what you're doing for this family.
Thank you, sir.
Sweet, sweet story. That's going to do it for us. The World's Theme Music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Snow or no snow, have yourselves a wonderful weekend. We're going to leave you now with some of the music David McNabb wisely chose for his sledding video, Jimmy Cliff's version of the Johnny Nash hit, I Can See Clearly Now.
PRI, Public Radio International.